Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Benno Hertz on the show. Benno was named program director at the Thomas Mann House in Los Angeles in spring 2022 and was previously project manager at the house. Prior to this, he studied theater, film, and media at Goethe University in Frankfurt, where he completed his master's with a focus on digital aesthetics and interface theory. Since 2009, he's been creatively engaged in several music and film projects as a writer and instrumentalist. The focus of our conversation today is a book that he edited with Nikolai Blaumer and with illustrations done by John Stitch called Thomas Mann's Los Angeles, Stories from Exile, 1940 to 1952. This book is an amazing collection of essays and illustrations discussing the contributions of many émigrés and exiles who made it and contributed to California in and around World War II. Please enjoy our conversation. We're going to start with a simple question to start this podcast. Buddenbrooks or the Magic Mountain?
For me, that's an easy one. I would say the Magic Mountain at any given time.
Okay, why?
Because it sort of transcends its culture and time in a way. I feel as much as I love diving back into the Buddenbrooks, and as great as it is, it's sort of very tied to this sort of German bourgeois family and the sort of traditions and aesthetics. And, you know, the whole narrative world is set in that specific environment. And I mean, you could say the same thing about the Magic Mountain, but in a way it feels more universal.
Mm-hmm. And therefore more of a novel of ideas versus something that's tied to a place.
Exactly. I mean, that's how Knopf, his publisher, would advertise his novels here in the United States, novels of ideas.
Yes, yes. And if you were talking to a Thomas Mann neophyte, where would you say they should start?
I mean, it's interesting. It's an interesting question because, I mean, as a German who obviously went through the, you know, German education system, you're confronted with a Thomas Mann that is quite a canonical, institutionalized figure that seems quite, you know, like heavy and can be very stiff and loaded at times in a way, its image. But, you know, once I came to California and I rediscovered Thomas Mann, I really liked his political essays. For example, his speech, The Coming Victory of Democracy. They're like very short, comprehensive texts, very engaging, but with very vivid descriptions. So I would really recommend one of those, The Coming Victory of Democracy, or one of his 55 radio broadcasts that he recorded.
Do you think Death in Venice is kind of a tough sell for modern readers today, for students, particularly with evolving moral and political points of view?
Yeah, especially after that sort of, I don't know if you followed the controversy around Visconti made a movie about them, a movie adaptation, and there were quite some controversies that were actually turned into a documentary film quite recently about the casting of the little boy and everything. It wouldn't be my favorite. If you look for another very entertaining and I think very easy to read novella, I would recommend Mario the Magician. It's about a narrator who travels to Italy and then basically becomes a witness of sort of the emerging fascism in Europe.
I have not read that one. I did read Death in Venice for the first time a couple years ago, and while I was entranced by it, I had thoughts running through my head about, you know, if you assigned it in a freshman literature seminar, you know, the kinds of conversations that might emerge from reading that. I'm curious because I actually I wasn't a literature major in college or didn't study in graduate school, but in the classes I did take in K-12 and in university, I don't think I read any Thomas Mann. But what was in the German schooling system, how is he treated for you? What was your experience of him?
Yeah, first of all, I think I just said Mario the Magician, but the title of the novella is Mario and the Magician.
Okay, gotcha.
Too excited to be on the pod.
Yeah, there you go.
And so my high school education is now a little bit in the past already, but I remember, so we had to read the Buddenbrooks, and I know that we read parts of the Magic Mountain, and I think we also read Death in Venice. So my exposure, I had a high exposure to Mann. I wonder how it's like for kids in Germany these days. I was surprised, though, I have to say, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of Mann's Magic Mountain this year. It was published in November 2024. 1924. And I've encountered a lot of like students and people of all ages who were like either telling me we just like read it for the first time, or for some reason it ended up in our algos because they're interested in literature. And it seems to still resonate with many people.
Yeah. Well, I read it for the first time a couple years ago and was disappointed I hadn't been able to read it in the context of some kind of classroom to be able to discuss it, because it seems like a novel that would lead to, great discussion in a room full of engaged people interested in ideas. We're gonna get into the Thomas Mann house in a little bit, but I want to talk about your background to kind of lead into the book. So is your background in aesthetics and interface theory, did that lead you to design the book in a certain way? And can you kind of talk about visually and structurally how the book was designed?
Yeah, so I think it's important to mention that I think at the time the book sort of we started to develop the book or came up with the first idea for the book, we were in the midst of the global pandemic, and the Thomas Mann House here in LA, which is usually a site for residents to live and stay and do programs and lectures, etc., was closed. So my co-editor Nikolai Blaumer and me at the time were thinking about ways to sort of think about the house or use the house's stories in different forms than in-person events. And one thing that was so inspiring about working at the Thomas Mann House was that you would have people coming in to the house all the time telling us these different stories that happened here. For example, when Einstein visited Mann there, or when, this film producer came and talked, had this and that conversation with Mann. And it seemed like every time you would like go after like one of those anecdotes, you would discover like five other little anecdotes that were somehow connected with Los Angeles or like intellectuals that were active in Los Angeles in the 1940s. And we first started actually to then implement these stories as little social media posts. We called it hashtag Mann's LA. And we put pins on little maps on current day maps of LA, and then basically went to the archives, found little historical pictures and stuff, and that resonated very well with our followers and generated more interest. We were at one point approached by a digital humanities program at UCLA, and they thought, wouldn't that be a great idea to sort of use these materials and historical stories and combine them with like DH methods and use like story maps and stuff like that. So we taught a class about it. And that leads me to the answer to your question, which is yes, I think not just thinking about it in terms of like how to write a scholarly book or how to write a nonfiction book. We already had this sort of like multimedia-ish approach in mind that we wanted to include maps and pins and make it accessible and sort of take it away from the realm of the purely scholarly or historical and really like map it onto today's Los Angeles.
Yeah, and I love the kind of multimedia approach. I have interacted with that more in the poetry space. Where I am in Central California, we had a poet, Anthony Cody, who had a great book called Borderland Apocrypha, where he took pieces of different media and kind of intersected that with poetry. And recently, another poet here, Mitra Vang, who just published a book called Yellow Rain. And it she includes government documents and different illustrations throughout to kind of capture the meaning. And so I was curious for you, what function do the illustrations in the book serve for you in terms of the meaning of the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think since the book is designed as a sort of like, coffee table book, or also as a guide to people who are perhaps not aware of that period in time or of that specific group of people or stories, I think it was important to Nikolai and me that we would design the book or develop the book in a way that it seems relevant today. It's not just like looking into histories, but it's also like looking into these histories and how they changed the present that we live in. And therefore, it seemed having these not only the historical photos, but to combine those with these paintings and drawings, makes it more tangible and brings it into the realm of the creative and of the contemporary. And I think having both of these aspects together in the book, the archival sources, but then also these more imaginative drawings, I think makes it just more fun to engage with.
You have such a large collection of contributors to this. From an editor's perspective, what was it like to try to coordinate and assemble all of these disparate sources from different places?
Yeah, it was a lot of work, but I have to say we had a great team with Angel City Press. Terry, our editor there, did a great job in helping us streamline all the texts and all of the contributors. We already, you know, either we knew about their work and had worked with them before, or we already were friends with them. So everybody was very excited about the project from the very get-go. So it also didn't feel like you had to run after a lot of people. It all came together very naturally.
Well, let's jump into talking about exile and moving to the United States. A while ago, we had Boris Yarlok on the show, and we talked about kind of the waves of Russian refugees and immigrants to Los Angeles. And there was also waves from Germany and other places throughout Europe. And so I guess my first question is, why do you think Mann left earlier than maybe some of the other refugees? Or I guess, is refugees the right word to use here, or exiles, or... I guess I'm searching here for the correct term, but why did he leave early? And can you also talk about why Los Angeles was chosen as opposed to somewhere like New York, which is on the East Coast and maybe closer, relatively speaking?
Yeah, just on a side note, I'm a huge fan of Boris's work. He was actually, while he was still at Los Angeles Review of Books, he was on the board of the Thomas Mann House. So I'm very familiar with his most recent book. But to get to your question, I think it's a wonderful way to sort of begin telling this story. Because as you already mentioned, it's not one coherent group that left Germany at one specific time. And I mean, it becomes very important when you look at the community of German-speaking exiles in Los Angeles, just because there were these different waves. For example, there were people, for example, in the Weimar cinema, classic Weimar cinema era, like Ernst Lubitsch, the director, for example, or Fritz Lang, that would already come to Hollywood in the 1920s on their own terms, 10 years before Hitler even came to power. And these people already settled here. But you could also had the architects like the Viennese Richard Neutra and Rudolf Schindler from Vienna, who came to work with Frank Lloyd Wright in Chicago and then eventually ended up in Los Angeles already towards the end of the 20s. So by the time the first real refugees from Hitler Germany arrived in 1933 after the seizure of power, there was already a community of German-speaking intellectuals and artists and professionals here in Los Angeles that at this point were in some cases even already naturalized and US citizens. Then you had the early wave beginning in 1933 when after the Nuremberg Laws and then later after the annexation left the European capitals and came to Los Angeles. And then you had the very last late arrivals in the beginning of the 1940s after the Nazis occupied France. And these were like the very last people who made it out. Sometimes their flight paths are just incredibly insane. They were then in France. They had to make it through Spain, across the Pyrenees by foot to eventually make it to Lisbon and then make it onto one of those boats to eventually get to the United States. And once these people all arrived in Los Angeles, you can already tell that it wasn't like a one homogenous group. There were like conflicts along the lines of course, class. At the time when, you know, Horkheimer and Brecht and Adorno arrived, you know, like people like Neutra were already in California for 15 years and they felt like they're Americans. And so there were interesting group dynamics. And interestingly, I mean, most or all of them became refugees by the time they couldn't return into either like, you know, occupied Austria or into Germany. So it's an interesting question to think about this term refugee, because of course the Manns were refugees stripped of their German citizenship, persecution, they couldn't have returned to Germany. So, you know, there were not a lot of places for them to be after their last stop in Switzerland. But on the other hand, I mean, if Neutra would have returned to Austria in 1940, wouldn't have also ended good for him probably. So some of them became involuntary refugees, even though they left Europe on their own terms.
Were the respective waves treated differently? Because, they're entering different political situations upon when they arrive. Refugees in 1933 are entering a different situation than in 1940, for example.
Absolutely. So there was the American Immigration Act of 1924 that only allowed a certain percentage of ethnic minorities along the population of the United States that already existed. And unfortunately, German Jews were classified under the category of German ethnicity. So even for the Jewish refugee coming from Germany and Austria, there was only a certain percentage allowed each year. And that made it pretty hard for people to obtain additional visas beyond the quota. And so that was the one part. And the other part was then with the beginning of World War II and the United States entering World War II, that there were then other obstacles. For example, an executive order that made curfews for German citizens mandatory. I think it was called a notice to aliens of enemy nations by the Department of Justice. And that, for example, made it even harder for them to get affidavits of support, obtain citizenship later on, get work permits. And sometimes these issues were quite Kafkaesque. So you would only be able to get a job once you had a certain permit. But to get the permit, you had to have to prove that you have work. And, for example, it was interesting because the Manns were stripped of their German citizenship in 1935 by the Nazis and entered the United States as Czechoslovakians. So they didn't have these kind of problems.
Yeah. What was the financial situation upon arriving in Los Angeles? And I have to say, when I was reading the section about them getting off the train at Union Station and just kind of picturing them strolling out through those same doors I've gotten out of trains. We're always walking around on historical steps, but it's funny to kind of read it and think about it and visualize it. So anyway, but to circle back, what was their financial situation upon arrival?
So to speak more broadly about most of the refugees from Europe to Los Angeles, it was pretty bad. The Nazis had frozen most of the accounts. Only a few were able to save belongings from their former residences or homes or apartments. Some were traveling just with very light luggage, barely being able to save whatever they could when given their individual flight circumstance. And then also, of course, specifically for the writers, they didn't get any royalties because of the book bans in Germany. They couldn't sell their work. And so for most of the writers, like for example, Bertolt Brecht or also Heinrich Mann, Thomas Mann's brother, it was quite hard financially. And that's also one of the reasons why Hollywood was so attractive to many of those writers, is because the Hollywood industry took quite an active stance in helping many of these refugees. So, for example, MGM and Warner provided them with short-term writing contracts. So they would contract them to write little parts for movie scripts. And that would help them to then get green cards and make it through the month. As for the Mann family, it was a bit different. Thomas Mann had already won the Nobel Prize in 1929. The Magic Mountain was already translated and quite a veritable success in the United States. So was the Death in Venice. And he had just published the beginning of his Joseph saga, like a tetralogy that was another bestseller here in the United States. And so when Mann came here in 1939, he was already a public figure in the United States. People knew him, knew his novels, and that, of course, put him in a more privileged situation than many other writers.
I don't want to dispute anything in the book, but Erica Mann's description of the Pacific Palisades being like parts of Germany feels a little hyperbolic. And I don't know. I mean, I've been to the Pacific Palisades and I've been to Germany. I don't know if they remind me of each other. What is the meaning of that quotation, and why did you include that at the front there?
Oh, is it the one about we're at home in Pacific
Yes,
Palisades?
yes, 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 yes.
I see. Yeah. Would it be okay for if I read this little quote by
Yeah,
Erica Mann
I think
to the
it's great.
listeners? Yeah.
I'm questioning it. I think it's great.
Okay, so I'm reading a quote now from Erica Mann, Thomas Mann's daughter, who also accompanied him and his wife Katja to Los Angeles. And she's a super fascinating person herself, war reporter, playwright, journalist, and she helped her father a lot here in Los Angeles. So, quote, "Where are we? In the study. But which one? in the Tollhaus, behind which the fir forest darkens and from whose open veranda one has a beautiful view of snowy peaks of the Karwendel Mountains? Maybe. In Munich, by the river Isar? But the house in which we grew up and in which you thought you would grow old is no longer. So where are we? In the Nidenhaus, on the Kuranian Sprit? The thought would be obvious. We are obviously at home, and it's summer sea air which comes through the open window. No, it is clear. We are where we will stay, at home in Pacific Palisades.
Okay, maybe I misread it. Maybe I was saying she was seeing reminiscences of where she had lived, where she is now. But is the meaning something else?
I think the meaning is that they liked it so much, that they felt so at home. And that's interesting because I think this has a different meanings or reasons behind it. Because, of course, the most obvious one would be they love the weather, the Mediterranean climate. I mean, that's like that's what a lot of like of the European refugees commented on, that like the proximity to like the Italian climate in Tuscany and the olive trees and palm trees. Of course, that played a role. But I think both Erika and also Thomas were huge admirers of Roosevelt, the American president, and saw the United States, especially at that time, as basically the antithesis to Nazi Germany. Mm. I think they couldn't imagine leaving this place because they just liked it a lot.
Mm. Fantastic. Let's talk about the house itself. So there was a couple architects that were considered. Can you talk about the three architects that are mentioned in the book? And do you think if they had chosen one of the other two, the result would have been better?
That's a good question. Yeah. So the first remarkable thing about this house is that the Manns were the first refugee family from Germany who actually decided to buy a lot and build a home. I mean, at the time, people were still sort of like hoping that that war might end soon, that they might be able to return to Germany. But beginning Mann observing the war scenario in Europe by 1940 was like, okay, this is not going to end anytime soon. And them deciding to buy this, to purchase this lot, was really also sort of a shockwave through the emigre community, because it became clear, okay, Thomas Mann, the big towering lighthouse figure of the German literary community in exile, is now building a house in Los Angeles. And therefore, of course, there was a lot of media attention. The LA Times, the Santa Monica, local papers, they all covered the laying of the groundstone. And so, of course, also the type of architecture he would choose, he knew would be a topic of public relevance. And the three architects that you're referring to were Richard Neutra, who at the time was already a huge star in the Californian architecture scene. He had already built his famous Lovell Health House in the Hollywood Hills in 1927. He was already, you know, on the cover of different of Times magazine and stuff. And he really felt entitled to be the architect for the house. I mean, the greatest living man of letters would settle in LA, and he was the biggest architect in LA. So he really wanted to do it. And he took Mann on a tour of his houses here in LA. And the next day, Mann writes in his diary, unpleasant glass box style. And so he's not super fond of Neutra's more radical and progressive approach to modernism. And there's a funny anecdote that once Neutra realized that Mann wasn't sort of like responding to his inquiry, he approached Mann at a party at Vicky Baum, the writer's at a party. And eventually Mann was shouting, get that Neutra off my back. So the two weren't really getting along really well with each other. He then approached, and I think the other architect you were mentioning is, one second, I think his name is Paul Laszlo Löwenstein.
Yeah,
an Hungarian architect that the family really liked, but I think the offers or his bids came in too expensive.
Okay.
And so they decided to go with another modernist architect. His name is Julius Ralph Davidson, also a German-Jewish emigre who came to LA in the 20s and who was sort of willing to build a more moderate version of California modernism for the family.
What's your favorite architectural feature of the house?
I think I really like So the silhouette, looking at it from outside and seeing this like long L-shaped, stretched out geometrical shape in with the palm trees next to it, has something incredibly elegant and majestic about it. But I also really love the study, which is sort of also how Davidson sort of conceived the house, that you would go from the most trivial to the most holy. So which means like there was the garage, and then you would like go through the kitchen and the dining room to the living room, and then sort of shifted away in a weird like 90 degree angle is the study. And if you're in the study, it's like this square huge room with two giant windows. You really feel like you're on the captain of a big ship or something.
You mentioned before all the famous people that have come through the house. Mentioned Einstein, many directors. If you could pick one party or one meeting to be a fly on the wall for, is there one that comes to mind that you could wish you could listen in on?
Yes. I'm thinking about this a lot actually, because when Mann was working on his novel Dr. Faustus, which revolves around a musician, a composer, he was studying 12-tone music and modern music to prepare the writing of this book. And as a teacher, he hired Theodor Adorno, the philosopher, to come by his house and explain to him Schoenberg's 12-tone music and the 12-tone row in his living room. And
Wow.
I would give everything to be a fly on the wall to hear what they talked about. And
That's incredible. How has the house, if at all, changed since the 1940s? Has there been updates to it? Obviously, its function is different now, but has there been any structural changes or change? There's obviously been changes of use of space, but I'm curious about physical changes.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me circle back a little bit to talk about to briefly talk about the architecture in general, just because I mentioned because Mann and Neutra didn't go well. And if you look at all of the other houses that the Mann family had either occupied or built or owned before the house on San Remo Drive, they were like more traditional, like European bourgeois villas. So the reason that Thomas Mann went for an international style mid-century modern home is interesting in and of itself. And as many Mann scholars have written, it was probably also about the sort of public image and the idea that he would give to the public. And I mean, he famously told the LA Times, with this house, I want to become a real Californian. So choosing this type of architecture was already sort of not a publicity stunt, but it was sort of consciously letting the American public know that he would want to be perceived as an American. Because Davidson, the architect, also wanted to do the interior design, but Mann fired Davidson once the house was completed and hired an old friend from Munich to basically recreate his bourgeois, like dark living room of his Munich apartment with like dark rugs and like Lübecker chandeliers and all this old European furniture. So there was this interesting paradox between the sort of white, bright, geometrical California modern exterior and the sort of recreation of a lost home on the interior. And in a way, that's also a very, sad and fitting metaphor for many refugees, sort of adaptation on the outside, but a recreation of a lost home on the inside. So when the and I think that's just an important, I think what an interesting anecdote about the genesis of the house. And when the house was up for, so the Manns left in 52, the house was in the hands of a family for all those years up until 2016, when it showed up on Redfin, the real estate platform, and it was advertised as a teardown house, as a spec house. At this point, the Palisades are one of the most sought after neighborhoods in Greater LA. Square footage prices are insane, and of course the footprint of the house is tiny compared to all these mega houses you see. So it feels a little bit outdated, but luckily when it popped up on Redfin, some people did recognize its cultural significance and whose house it was, and so there was this momentum that journalists wrote about it, and the German media picked up, and eventually the German government purchased the house.
Wow. And then can you describe its current function and use today?
So of course, I mean, it was an old house, so there had to be a sort of a very careful restoration process. And as far as I understood it, the main contractor and architect tried to preserve as much of the original substance of the house, while at the same time updating the house in terms of, like security and just like to make it livable for five residents today. And so I think some of the features that have been changed most is probably that the garage and the room next to the garage have been turned into two additional rooms, like apartments. And of course, some other smaller features have been changed. But I think most importantly, the architects decide to sort of update the house a little bit more in line with how the mid-century modernists would have probably designed it. So, for example, the living room back in the 40s only had like one big window on each side, and they opened it up with adding like these huge window panels on both sides. So you have this like bright light coming into the living room, and more of this idea of like blurring the boundaries between indoors and outdoors, sort of make it a little bit more in line with mid-century modernism, I guess. But the main features and the main rooms and the kitchen, it's all still there.
Fantastic. I want to jump into some different sections throughout that you discuss throughout the book, along film, music, and literature, and then some questions about ideas. But let's maybe start by talking about this perception that exists that it's kind of a one-way street in terms of intellectual and philosophical history with ideas coming from Europe to the United States. But Mann was very interested in American ideas and the intellectual culture of the United States. So can you talk about that maybe to start, and then we'll get into some more specific topics.
Yeah, thank you for bringing this up, because I always try to challenge this idea that ideas can travel one way, because I don't believe it. And even if you if it seems like it, you will always find proof that it's not just that. That's why I'm also sort of I don't really like using the term Weimar on the Pacific, as oftentimes this community of German expats and refugees was described. Because it sort of like gives this idea that people would just come to an empty space and recreate the ideals of the Weimar Republic, which is sort of not really what happened. Because I mean, if you go through Thomas Mann's diaries, if you look at the interactions between many of these German-speaking exiles and their American friends and helpers and supporters, there's an incredible amount of reciprocal ideas, exchanging ideas and supporting each other, inspiring each other. Mann was starting to read contemporary American literature, Sinclair Lewis, Walt Whitman, and of course the everyday culture. I mean, reading about Mann going to like the Brown Derby, having like ice cream and onion soup with like Max Horkheimer while Horkheimer is writing the Dialectic of the Enlightenment. It's just, it's incredible how multifaceted these exile experiences were.
Yeah, let's talk about film to start, because that's kind of one of my favorites. I think I've watched almost every Fritz Lang film.
Wow.
And I have my favorites. I tend to like his silent period the most. I think that's, but those noir films of the late 40s, early 50s are also quite enjoyable. So I guess my broader question before we get into specific people, can you talk a little bit about how German expressionism as kind of an approach to filmmaking changed or led to change in American cinema?
Yeah, I'm a huge Fritz Lang fan as well. I have to say my favorite is M,
Oh yeah,
Einstein
me
zu einem
too.
Mörder.
Yes. M is the best one. And
I
that's
think
not
so
his
too.
first film, but it was early, right? It's one of the early films.
Yeah, I think it's like a 1931 or something like this,
Yeah,
just
yeah,
like
yeah.
foreshadowing the Nazi rule very early in
Oh,
the
yeah.
30s. And
What's the name of the actor with the eyes? I always call him the actor with the eyes. What's his name?
Peter Lorre and
Peter Lorre, that's right. His name always escapes me. His eyes in that film are just the most memorable thing. You can just picture his face in that basement with all those people standing around him. You know what I mean? It's just something that's so memorable.
It's given me the chills just thinking about that scene that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And I mean, both Laurie and Flang ended up in Los Angeles, and both had quite some successful careers, actually. This so it's interesting because in the 1920s, like the golden age of like German cinema based in like the Universum Film in the Babelsberg Studios in Berlin, produced so many huge talents that already in the 20s would eventually go to Hollywood, like Ernst Lubitsch, for example, Marlene Dietrich, an actress, but also Fritz Lang, of course, and there are many others. And at the time, this is also pre-sound film. The German film industry was still sort of competing with Hollywood. And then, of course, with the Nazis coming in 1933, all of these, most of these people, were either forced to quit their jobs or faced incredible workplace harassment. I mean, also, like many, many people working in the film industry were Jewish. There was the Reichskulturkammer that basically started to streamline movies according to Nazi propaganda. And you had this like massive exodus of like film professionals. I think around about 2,000 people working in the German film industry leaving Germany. And of course, first going to the other European film capitals in Vienna and Paris. But then, of course, towards the end of the 30s, these places weren't safe anymore. And so most of them came to Hollywood. And of course, there are the big shining figures like Lubitsch and Lang and Dietrich and maybe Dieterle were
Wilder,
already Wilder, who everybody knows. But then there were also all these other people who worked in the film industry, like camera operators, of course, actors who had a really hard time adjusting to like the language barrier, often being cast as like Nazi villains in the in the Nazi anti-war movies, which is incredible when you think about it. But I think, as you already mentioned, the biggest imprint these this sort of like this exodus of German film professionals to LA brought was the sort of, I think, the development of film noir as a genre. Because they basically, if you look at these like 1920s expressionist German like pre-horror movies, like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Metropolis, Dr. Mabuse, and these movies, you have these hard, harsh black and white contrasts and this sort of idea that sets don't rim. They use these like avant-garde theater set designs where, like, for example, the silhouette of a city at night wouldn't be a photograph of that, but it would be like some kind of like geometrical surrealist set piece that would reset with long shadows. And then, many of these people would then apply these sort of stylistic devices to like these heart-bitten urban crime stories. And that's how this genre basically emerged.
Yeah, and there's even call back to it now. I mean, I don't know if you would interpret it this way, but Francis Ford Coppola's new film that's coming out this year looks like it's a nod to that particular era and some of those movies that came out then. Can you also talk about how it created a culture of auteurs? And it seems like that may have emerged without the arrival of these refugees, but it definitely accelerated it.
Yeah, absolutely. The so people like directors like Lubitsch or Lang, Lang had already a huge success with Metropolis, for example. They had an incredible freedom at as directors in with the German production system. And when they came to Hollywood, they sort of they had to learn to adjust to the studio system. That there were hierarchies, that the studio would decide on certain creative decisions, that other people would come in. And for example, Lang had quite a hard time to actually adjust to that. And for a long time, he didn't get work because people refused to work with him. And on the other hand, many German filmmakers influenced the way Hollywood was making movies by. So for example, there's a great ex Lang is yet another good a good example because he would like meticulously plan every shot, every tracking shot, every little thing on set versus. In the American system, you would build a giant set in a studio and you would shoot whatever you need and then pick what you need. And Lang would be incredibly like exact about the order in which he wanted to shoot which film. And these sort of like clashes and then of course synergies that happened because of these different production styles. Another reason because of that is because film stock was so rare in Germany that they weren't used to having this sort of abundance of material when they first started in Hollywood. And then of course language barriers and it wasn't always easy to get into the guilds as Germans, especially after America entered the war.
Okay, last question on film. before we move on? Double Indemnity or Sunset Boulevard? What's your choice?
Wow, that's a hard one.
Got to
But I
pick.
guess Sunset Boulevard.
Okay. Why do you prefer that one?
Because I think Norma Desmond's quote when she says, "It's the movies that got small." It might be one of my favorite lines in film history. And of course, I think, was it the first time this sort of like voice, this like dark voiceover from the dead narrator was applied in
I think so. I think so. I think I love Sunset. I might go the opposite way, but we can argue about that after. All right. Let's let's.
have you seen the new Apple TV limited series? What's it called? Sugar with Colin Farrell? Because it's basically like it's a completely like over the top styled film noir detective show where they actually like Colin Farrell's character is obsessed with film noir, and then he would like he drives in a like in an old Corvette convertible through LA, and then they would cut these original clips from these film noirs into the show.
I need to watch that. That sounds incredible. Let's jump to Adorno and Horkheimer. How did Los Angeles maybe lead to the dialectic of enlightenment?
Again, if you look into the diaries, like in the case of Mann, in these daily interactions, you find the most hilarious and interesting stuff. And it's the same for Horkheimer and Adorno. And I think to me, one key piece or one key text that really sort of explained to me what a huge impact California had on Adorno's thinking is a text that he pub it's titled The Stars Down to Earth. And throughout the 40s, Adorno became obsessed with the horoscope section in the LA Times. And so every day he would go like read the horoscope section and then eventually do like this huge analysis of horoscopes in the LA Times and what it means and how it becomes a substitute for missing religion. And basically, horoscope becomes like a substitute for meaning in life and projecting one's own misery in a harsh capitalist society onto the stars, and that LA was the only place where this could be so successful. And it's super interesting. And you really see how, LA and the United States and the American version of like capitalism at the time influenced Adorno's thinking quite literally.
I love this anecdote from this English philosopher, Simon Crickley, I think his name. He got a fellowship to write something in Los Angeles. He was giving a talk and he mentioned that, like, living in Los Angeles for him as a philosopher taught him everything he needed to learn about nihilism. And he just described just being just like the sun beaming down in his eyes, just what felt like 16 hours a day, and then just waddling back and forth to the taquerias to get more food. So I'm just picturing Adorno and Horkheimer walking down the streets of Hollywood, kind of in the sun, glaring in their eyes.
And finally, I mean, I have always so much fun with the haters, with like some of these like intellectual German refugees who like had a hard time adjusting. For example, like Brecht, who like in one of his poems basically says something like, he always thought that London would be hell on earth, but now he knows that it's Los Angeles. The writer who basically said, yeah, people say it's so green and there's so much nature here, but am I a cow?
Did Mann's distaste for modernist architecture, was it that extended to music as well?
I mean, interestingly, in the it was a love and love hate. It was very ambiguous, I'd say, because, for example, he, of course, Dr. Faustus caused this huge friction within the emigre community because it was basically based on the real life composer Arnold Schönberg. So all of the composing techniques he depicts quite detailed in this book are based on Schönberg's 12-tone row, etc. And to come up with this invention in the book, the composer sells his soul to the devil. And Schönberg at the time took this incredibly personal. He was quite, upset about it. And this caused a fight between the families and eventually between many of the emigre community here in Los Angeles. But I mean, the fact that Thomas Mann would like go through all the trouble of like studying this like new system of composition with the help of Adorno shows that he was definitely super interested, right? And interestingly, the same goes when you look at like his relationship towards cinema and film, for example, that, you know, even though his own work, like Dr. Faustus or other works he wrote in exile, is still set in like German environments and like, you know, small town Germany, and you won't find anything that is set in LA, but still the sort of like, he starts to write more collage like, you know, and from his diaries, we know that he would watch a lot of like film noir, and he would go to Westwood, to the cinema. It's like, you find that like three times a week, he would go to like Westwood, to the Bruin Theater with the beautiful, you know, the Fox, the Mission style theater, and watch, you know, Streetcar Named Desire and comment on Brando's performance and stuff. So he was in a way super aware of American popular culture, but also of course on about modernist art at the time.
Okay. One more question before we go to kind of broad closing thoughts. Which contribution in your book did you personally learn the most from? Or is there one that stands out to you that is interesting and maybe underrated in the insights that it brought to you?
I think I have to say, I really love so the book is structured along different characters that always go together with a place. And of course, there are all the big names, right? Many of them we already mentioned, but it was really, you know, about the people who I did not know a lot about that I learned most about. For example, the role of many of the women that back in the day would often like be referred to like Frau Thomas Mann, like Mrs. Thomas Mann, or Frau Leon Feuchtwanger, when in fact, for example, there was this help organization called the European Film Fund. It was basically invented by Lubitsch and others to collect money in Hollywood and funnel it towards newly arrived refugees and get them set up with money and jobs in the film industry. And you always hear like Lubitsch's name, but I mean, when you look at the actual work, the everyday administrative work, it was Charlotte Frank and Liesel Frank and Charlotte Dieterle, who basically ran the whole operation and probably single-handedly saved I don't know how many people and made their flight to the United States possible. And it's these sort of like little stories, these overlooked stories that I think I took away with most.
Okay. Here's a question kind of on the similar to the intellectual exchange that we talked about before. How did LA change the exiles? And then how did the exiles change LA? If you were trying to broadly summarize.
Yeah. I mean, one topic we didn't touch on in our conversation today is the sort of sad turn of events post 1945 with, you know, McCarthyism and the Red Scare. And of course, most of the people we talked about today were hugely affected by that development because they all were either considered to be premature anti-fascists. So, for example, Mann was celebrated as a, you know, outspoken anti-fascist and like pro-democracy champion during the war. But after the war, the same magazines that would celebrate him for being that would accuse him of being a potential communist sympathizer. And I mean, in some of these cases that was the case. I mean, Feuchtwanger interviewed Stalin in the 30s, or like Brecht was an outspoken communist. He was called in front of the House of Un-American Activities Committee already in 1947 and left the next day. But I think that's the sort of like deciding the most important development, because unfortunately many of the refugees left Los Angeles again, even though if they didn't want to. For example, Hans Eisler, the composer, eventually Thomas Mann in 1952, many Horkheimer, Adorno, Brecht. But then there are all these amazing success stories of people like Billy Wilder. I mean, he came in 1934 as a Polish Jew on a boat. And, you know, 15 years later, he produced some of the most defining films of the classic Hollywood era, right? Or let me think, who else? Billy Wilder, of course. And in a way, they all left their impact. I mean, also when you think about what Neutra, I mean, he wasn't a refugee who was forced out. He already came to work with Wright in the 20s, but still, he really changed the way we think of California almost, right? Cubist hillside residences, but also the schools. I mean, if you look at the typical California school with the sliding glass windows and the hallways, the big long L shapes, The first one was in Bell, the Corona Bell School or something was it called by Neutra, that then basically became the blueprint for, West Coast high schools. Just two random, very random examples from the
Yeah.
top of my head. Sorry.
No. I also like people to think about how their work relates to the history of California. So through this research and this process of putting together this book, how did your perspective on the history of California change?
It really showed me what an incredibly multifaceted, rich, and complex place this is. How, there's this sort of like notion that many like, or you often hear from like Europeans that would say something like, oh, but there is no culture in LA, or it's only the movies, or it's like a plastic world. And the more you dive into LA's history, you see that it's incredible, the complexity of ethnic, cultural, artistic levels the city has. It's and I and it keeps giving. I feel like the more I research, the more I discover, and the more I think I understood something, then I find something else that like troubles that narrative again. And I think I just it really fueled my love for the history of LA and California even more.
Yeah, for such a, in the grand scheme of things, relatively new city in, the history of, development of cities. There's such a rich history there, and it's still one of my favorite places to be. Now, to
Yeah.
close, we always close with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Yeah, so I would, if you really want to get a good overview, I would recommend Erhard Bahr's book, Weimar on the Pacific, Immigrant Modernism and the Crisis of Modernism, I think it's called. Give me one second. Just one second. So Weimar on the Pacific, German Exile Culture in Los Angeles and the Crisis of Modernism. That is a great book. And then I can also highly recommend this book by David Yeneman titled Adorno in America, which is a wonderful exploration of the sort of impact LA had on critical th theory and how Adorno and Horkheimer interacted with American culture.
Perfect. Well, I'm going to try, since it's a 100-year anniversary, I'm going to try to crack open the Magic Mountain again. It's been a number of years since I've gone down that journey. I think I'll crack it. I can actually see it on my bookshelf from where I'm sitting. So it's been leering at me.
And I know we're running out of time, but do you think I can I plug something?
Oh yeah, I was going to ask you what projects you're working on and if there is anything you'd like to share.
Yeah, so I would just encourage the listeners, if they're interested in this period of time or in general of anything we talked about today, check out the Thomas Mann House online. We have a website. We do programs and talks and lectures, and it's possible to visit, and you'll find my contact info on the website and the program calendar. And I just would encourage everyone to have a look.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. I still haven't visited. I'm looking forward to. I need to get down to LA for a lot of reasons, and this is going to be one of those. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Jordan. Looking forward to have you at the Thomas Mann House.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.